Side 9. That's how I think about it often when I'm seated in my little niche, juggling the Havas reports or untangling the cables from Chicago, London, and Montreal. In between the rubber and silk markets and the Winnipeg grains, there oozes a little of the fizz and sizzle of the Faubourg Montmartre. When the bonds go weak and spongy, and the pivotals balk, and the volatiles effervesce, when the grain market slips and slides, and the bulls commence to roar, when every fucking calamity, every ad, every sport item and fashion article, every boat arrival, every travelogue, every tag of gossip has been punctuated, checked, revised, pegged and rung through the silver bracelets, when I hear the front page being hammered into whack and see the frogs dancing around like drunken squibs, I think of Lucienne sailing down the boulevard with her wings outstretched, a huge silver condor suspended over the sluggish tide of traffic, a strange bird from the tip of the Andes with a rose-white belly and a tenacious little knob. Sometimes I walk home alone, and I follow her through the dark streets, follow her through the court of the Louvre, over the Pont des Arts, through the arcade, through the fence and slits, the somnolence, the drugged whiteness, the grill of the Luxembourg, the tangled boughs, the snores and groans, the green slats, the strum and tinkle, the points of the stars, the spangles, the jetties, the blue and white striped awnings that she brushed with the tips of her wings. In the blue of an electric dawn, the peanut shells look wan and crumpled. Along the beach at Montparnasse, the water lilies bend and break. When the tide is on the ebb, and only a few syphilitic mermaids are left stranded in the muck, the dome looks like a shooting gallery that's been struck by a cyclone. Everything is slowly dribbling back to the sewer. For about an hour, there is a death-like calm, during which the vomit is mopped up. Suddenly, the trees begin to screech. From one end of the boulevard to the other, a demented song rises up. It is like the signal that announces the close of the exchange. What hopes there were are swept up. The moment has come to void the last bagful of urine. The day is sneaking in like a leper. One of the things to guard against when you work nights is not to break your schedule. If you don't get to bed before the birds begin to screech, it's useless to go to bed at all. This morning, having nothing better to do, I visited the Jardin des Plantes. Marvelous pelicans here from Chapultepec, and peacocks with studded fans that look at you with silly eyes. Suddenly it began to rain. Returning to Montparnasse in the bus, I noticed a little Frenchwoman opposite me, who sat stiff and erect, as if she were getting ready to preen herself. She sat on the edge of her seat, as if she feared to crush her gorgeous tail. Marvelous, I thought, if suddenly she shook herself, and from her derriere there sprang open a huge studded fan with long silken plumes. At the Café de l'Avenue, where I stop for a bite, a woman with a swollen stomach tries to interest me in her condition. She would like me to go to a room with her and while away an hour or two. It is the first time I have ever been propositioned by a pregnant woman. I am almost tempted to try it. As soon as the baby is born and handed over to the authorities, she will go back to her trade, she says. She makes hats. Observing that my interest is waning, she takes my hand and puts it on her abdomen. I feel something stirring inside. It takes my appetite away. I have never seen a place like Paris for varieties of sexual provender. As soon as a woman loses a front tooth or an eye or a leg, she goes on the loose. In America, she'd starve to death if she had nothing to recommend her but a mutilation. Here it is different. A missing tooth or a nose eaten away or a fallen womb, any misfortune that aggravates the natural homeliness of the female seems to be regarded as an added spice, a stimulant for the jaded appetites of the male. I am speaking naturally of that world which is peculiar to the big cities, the world of men and women whose last drop of juice has been squeezed out by the machine, the martyrs of modern progress. It is this mass of bones and collar buttons which the painter finds so difficult to put flesh on. It is only later, in the afternoon, when I find myself in an art gallery on the Rue de Sèze, surrounded by the men and women of Matisse, that I am drawn back again to the proper precincts of the human world. On the threshold of that big hall, whose walls are now ablaze, I pause for a moment to recover from the shock which one experiences when the habitual gray of the world is rent asunder and the color of life splashes forth in song and poem. I find myself in a world so natural, so complete, that I am lost. I have the sensation of being immersed in the very plexus of life, focal from whatever place, position, or attitude I take my stance. Lost, as when once I sank into the quick of a budding grove, and seated in the dining room of that enormous world of Balbec, I caught for the first time the profound meaning of these interior stills, which manifest their presence through the exorcism of sight and touch. Standing on the threshold of that world which Matisse has created, I re-experienced the power of that revelation which had permitted Proust to so deform the picture of life that only those who, like himself, are sensible to the alchemy of sound and sense are capable of transforming the negative reality of life into the substantial and significant outlines of art. Only those who can admit the light into their gizzards can translate what is there in the heart. Vividly now I recall how the glint and sparkle of light, caroming from the massive chandeliers, splintered and ran blood, flecking the tips of the waves that beat monotonously on the dull gold outside the windows. On the beach, masts and chimneys interlaced, and like a fuliginous shadow, the figure of Albertine gliding through the surf, fusing into the mysterious quick and prism of a protoplasmic realm, uniting her shadow to the dream and harbinger of death. With the close of day, pain rising like a mist from the earth, sorrow closing in, shuddering the endless vista of sea and sky. Two waxen hands lying listlessly on the bedspread, and along the pale veins, the fluted murmur of a shell repeating the legend of its birth. In every poem by Matisse, there is the history of a particle of human flesh which refused the consummation of death. The whole run of flesh, from hair to nails, expresses the miracle of breathing, as if the inner eye, in its thirst for a greater reality, had converted the pores of the flesh into hungry, seeing mouths. By whatever vision one passes, there is the odor and sound of voyage. It is impossible to gaze at even a corner of his dreams without feeling the lift of the wave and the cool of flying spray. He stands at the helm, peering with steady blue eyes into the portfolio of time. Into what distant corners has he not thrown his long, slanting gaze? Looking down the vast promontory of his nose, he has beheld everything. The Cordilleras falling away into the Pacific. The history of the diaspora done in vellum. Shutters fluting the frou-frou of the beach. The piano curving like a conch. Corollas giving out diapasons of light. Chameleons squirming under the book press, seraglios expiring in oceans of dust, music issuing like fire from the hidden chromosphere of pain, spore and madrepore fructifying the earth, navels vomiting their bright spawn of anguish. He is a bright sage, a dancing seer, who, with a sweep of the brush, removes the ugly scaffold to which the body of man is chained by the incontrovertible facts of life. He it is, if any man today, possesses the gift, who knows where to dissolve the human figure, who has the courage to sacrifice an harmonious line in order to detect the rhythm and murmur of the blood, who takes the light that has been refracted inside him and lets it flood the keyboard of color. Behind the minutia, the chaos, the mockery of life, he detects the invisible pattern. He announces his discoveries in the metaphysical pigment of space. No searching for formulae, no crucifixion of ideas, no compulsion other than to create. Even as the world goes to smash, there is one man who remains at the core, who becomes more solidly fixed and anchored, more centrifugal as the process of dissolution quickens. More and more, the world resembles an entomologist's dream. The Earth is moving out of its orbit. The axis has shifted. From the north, the snow blows down in huge, knife-blue drifts. A new ice age is setting in. The transverse sutures are closing up, and everywhere throughout the Corn Belt, the fetal world is dying, turning to dead mastoid. Inch by inch, the deltas are drying out, and the riverbeds are smooth as glass. A new day is dawning, a metallurgical day, when the earth shall clink with showers of bright yellow ore. As the thermometer drops, the form of the world grows blurred. Osmosis there still is, and here and there, articulation. But at the periphery, the veins are all varicose. At the periphery, the light waves bend, and the sun bleeds like a broken rectum. At the very hub of this wheel, which is falling apart, is Matisse. And he will keep on rolling until everything that has gone to make up the wheel is disintegrated. He has already rolled over a goodly portion of the globe, over Persia and India and China, and like a magnet, he has attached to himself microscopic particles from Kurd, Baluchistan, Timbuktu, Somaliland, Angkor, Tierra del Fuego. The odalisks he has studded with malachite and jasper, their flesh veiled with a thousand eyes, perfumed eyes dipped in the sperm of whales. Wherever a breeze stirs, there are breasts as cool as jelly. White pigeons come to flutter and rut in the ice-blue veins of the Himalayas. The wallpaper with which the men of science have covered the world of reality is falling to tatters. The grand whorehouse which they have made of life requires no decoration. It is essential only that the drains function adequately. Beauty, that feline beauty which has us by the balls in America, is finished. To fathom the new reality, it is first necessary to dismantle the drains, to lay open the gangrened ducts which compose the genito-urinary system that supplies the excreta of art. The odor of the day is permanganate and formaldehyde. The drains are clogged with strangled embryos. The world of Matisse is still beautiful in an old-fashioned bedroom way. There is not a ball bearing in evidence, nor a boilerplate, nor a piston, nor a monkey wrench. It is the same old world that went gaily to the Bois in the pastoral days of wine and fornication. I find it soothing and refreshing to move amongst these creatures with live, breathing pores, whose background is stable and solid as light itself. I feel it poignantly when I walk along the Boulevard de la Madeleine and the whores rustle beside me, when just a glance at them causes me to tremble. Is it because they are exotic or well-nourished? No. It is rare to find a beautiful woman along the Boulevard de la Madeleine. But in Matisse, in the exploration of his brush, there is the trembling glitter of a world which demands only the presence of the female to crystallize the most fugitive aspirations. To come upon a woman offering herself outside a urinal, where there are advertised cigarette papers, rum, acrobats, horse races, where the heavy foliage of the trees breaks the heavy mass of walls and roofs, is an experience that begins where the boundaries of the known world leave off. In the evening, now and then, skirting the cemetery walls, I stumble upon the phantom odalisques of Matisse, fastened to the trees, their tangled manes drenched with sap. A few feet away, removed by incalculable eons of time, lies the prone and mummy-swathed ghost of Baudelaire, of a whole world that will belch no more. In the dusky corners of cafes are men and women with hands locked, their loins slather-flecked. Nearby stands the garçon with his apron full of sous, waiting patiently for the entr'acte in order to fall upon his wife and gouge her. Even as the world falls apart, the Paris that belongs to Matisse shudders with bright, gasping orgasms. The air itself is steady with a stagnant sperm, the trees tangled like hair. On its wobbly axle, the wheel rolls steadily downhill. There are no brakes, no ball bearings, no balloon tires. The wheel is falling apart, but the revolution is intact. Out of a clear sky, there comes one day a letter from Boris, whom I have not seen for months and months. It is a strange document, and I don't pretend to understand it all clearly. What happened between us, at any rate as far as I go, is that you touched me, touched my life, that is, at the one point where I am still alive, my death. By the emotional flow, I went through another immersion. I lived again, alive. No longer by reminiscence, as I do with others, but alive. That's how it began. Not a word of greeting, no date, no address. Written in a thin, pompous scrawl on ruled paper torn out of a blank book. That is why, whether you like me or not, deep down, I rather think you hate me, you are very close to me. By you, I know how I died. I see myself dying again. I am dying. That is something, more than to be dead simply. That may be the reason why I am so afraid to see you. You may have played the trick on me and died. Things happen so fast nowadays. I'm reading it over, line by line, standing by the stones. It sounds nutty to me, all this palaver about life and death and things happening so fast. Nothing is happening that I can see, except the usual calamities on the front page. He's been living all by himself for the last 6 months, tucked away in a cheap little room, probably holding telepathic communication with Kronstadt. He talks about the line falling back, the sector evacuated, and so on and so forth, as though he were dug into a trench and writing a report to headquarters. He probably had his frock coat on when he sat down to pen this missive, and he probably rubbed his hands a few times as he used to do when a customer was calling to rent the apartment. "The reason I wanted you to commit suicide," he begins again. At that point, I burst out laughing. He used to walk up and down with one hand stuck in the tail flap of his frock coat at the Villa Borghese, or at Kronstadt's, wherever there was deck space, as it were, and reel off this nonsense about living and dying to his heart's content. I never understood a word of it, I must confess, but it was a good show, and being a Gentile, I was naturally interested in what went on in that menagerie of a brain pan. Sometimes he would lie on his couch, full length, exhausted by the surge of ideas that swept through his noodle. His feet just grazed the book rack, where he kept his Plato and Spinoza. He couldn't understand why I had no use for them. I must say, he made them sound interesting, though what it was all about, I hadn't the least idea. Sometimes I would gaze at a volume furtively to check up on these wild ideas which he imputed to them. But the connection was frail, tenuous. He had a language all his own, Boris, that is, when I had him alone. But when I listened to Kronstadt, it seemed to me that Boris had plagiarized his wonderful ideas. They talked a sort of higher mathematics, these two. Nothing of flesh and blood ever crept in. It was weird, ghostly, ghoulishly abstract. When they got onto the dying business, it sounded a little more concrete. After all, a cleaver or a meat axe has to have a handle. I enjoyed those sessions immensely. It was the first time in my life that death had ever seemed fascinating to me. All these abstract deaths which involved a bloodless sort of agony. Now and then they would compliment me on being alive, but in such a way that I felt embarrassed. They made me feel that I was alive in the 19th century, a sort of atavistic remnant, a romantic shred, a soulful Pithecanthropus erectus. Boris especially seemed to get a great kick out of touching me. He wanted me to be alive so that he could die to his heart's content. He would think that all those millions in the street were nothing but dead cows the way he looked at me and touched me. But the letter. I'm forgetting the letter. The reason why I wanted you to commit suicide that evening at the Kronstadt's, when Maldorf became God, was that I was very close to you then. Perhaps closer than I shall ever be. And I was afraid, terribly afraid, that someday you'd go back on me, die on my hands, and I would be left high and dry with my idea of you simply, and nothing to sustain it. I should never forgive you for that. Perhaps you can visualize him saying a thing like that. Myself, it's not clear what his idea of me was. Or at any rate, it's clear that I was just pure idea. An idea that kept itself alive without food. He never attached much importance, Boris, to the food problem. He tried to nourish me with ideas. Everything was an idea. Just the same, when he had his heart set on renting the apartment, he wouldn't forget to put a new washer in the toilet. Anyway, he didn't want me to die on his hands. "You must be life for me to the very end," so he writes. "That is the only way in which to sustain my idea of you. Because you have gotten, as you see, tied up with something so vital to me, I do not think I shall ever shake you off, nor do I wish to. I want you to live more vitally every day, as I am dead. That is why, when I speak of you to others, I am just a bit ashamed. It's hard to talk of oneself so intimately." You would imagine, perhaps, that he was anxious to see me, or that he would like to know what I was doing. But no, not a line about the concrete or the personal, except in this living-dying language. Nothing but this little message from the trenches, this whiff of poison gas, to apprise all and sundry that the war was still on. I sometimes ask myself how it happens that I attract nothing but crack-brained individuals. Neurasthenics, neurotics, psychopaths, and Jews especially. There must be something in a healthy Gentile that excites the Jewish mind, like when he sees sour black bread. There was Maldorf, for example, who had made himself God, according to Boris and Kronstadt. He positively hated me, the little viper, yet he couldn't stay away from me. He came round regularly for his little dose of insults. It was like a tonic to him. In the beginning, it's true, I was lenient with him. After all, he was paying me to listen to him. And though I never displayed much sympathy, I knew how to be silent when it involved a meal and a little pin money. After a while, however, seeing what a masochist he was, I permitted myself to laugh in his face now and then. That was like a whip for him. It made the grief and agony gush forth with renewed vigor. And perhaps everything would have gone smoothly between us if he had not felt it his duty to protect Tanya. But Tanya, being a Jewess, that brought up a moral question. He wanted me to stick to Mademoiselle Claude, for whom I must admit I had a genuine affection. He even gave me money occasionally to sleep with her, until he realized that I was a hopeless lecher. I mention Tanya now because she's just got back from Russia, just a few days ago. Sylvester remained behind to worm his way into a job. He's given up literature entirely. He's dedicated himself to the new utopia. Tanya wants me to go back there with her, to the Crimea preferably, and start a new life. We had a fine drinking bout up in Carl's room the other day, discussing the possibilities. I wanted to know what I could do for a living back there, if I could be a proofreader, for example. She said I didn't need to worry about what I would do. They would find a job for me as long as I was earnest and sincere. I tried to look earnest, but I only succeeded in looking pathetic. They don't want to see sad faces in Russia. They want you to be cheerful, enthusiastic, light-hearted, optimistic. It sounded very much like America to me. I wasn't born with this kind of enthusiasm. I didn't let on to her, of course, but secretly I was praying to be left alone, to go back to my little niche, and to stay there until the war breaks. All this hocus-pocus about Russia disturbed me a little. She got so excited about it, Tanya, that we finished almost a half dozen bottles of vin ordinaire. Carl was jumping about like a cockroach. He has just enough Jew in him to lose his head over an idea like Russia. Nothing would do but to marry us off, immediately. "Hitch up," he says. "You have nothing to lose." And then he pretends to run a little errand so that we can pull off a fast one. And while she wanted it all right, Tanya, still that Russian business had gotten so solidly planted in her skull that she pissed the interval away chewing my ear off, which made me somewhat grumpy and ill at ease. Anyway, we had to think about eating and getting to the office. So we piled into a taxi on the Boulevard Edgar Quinet, just a stone's throw away from the cemetery, and off we whizzed. It was just a nice hour to spin through Paris in an open cab, and the wine rolling around in our tanks made it seem even more lovely than usual. Carl was sitting opposite us, on the Strapontin, his face as red as a beet. He was happy, the poor bastard, thinking what a glorious new life he would lead on the other side of Europe. And at the same time, he felt a bit wistful, too. I could see that. He didn't really want to leave Paris any more than I did. Paris hadn't been good to him any more than it had to me, or to anybody for that matter. But when you've suffered and endured things here, it's then that Paris takes hold of you, grabs you by the balls, you might say, like some lovesick bitch who'd rather die than let you get out of her hands. That's how it looked to him. I could see that. Rolling over the Seine, he had a big foolish grin on his face, and he looked around at the buildings and the statues as though he were seeing them in a dream. To me, it was like a dream, too. I had my hand in Tanya's bosom, and I was squeezing her titties with all my might, and I noticed the water under the bridges, and the barges, and Notre Dame down below, just like the postcards show it. And I was thinking drunkenly to myself, that's how one gets fucked. But I was sly about it, too, and I knew I wouldn't ever trade all this whirling about my head for Russia or heaven or anything on earth. It was a fine afternoon, I was thinking to myself, and soon we'd be pushing a feed down our bellies, and what could we order as a special treat? Some good, heavy wine that would drown out all this Russia business. With a woman like Tanya, full of sap and everything, they don't give a damn what happens to you once they get an idea in their head. Let them go far enough, and they'll pull the pants off you, right in the taxi. It was grand, though, milling through the traffic, our faces all smudged with rouge, and the wine gurgling like a sewer inside us, especially when we swung into the Rue Lafitte, which is just wide enough to frame the little temple at the end of the street, and above it, the Sacré-Cœur. A kind of exotic jumble of architecture. A lucid French idea that gouges right through your drunkenness and leaves you swimming helplessly in the past, in a fluid dream that makes you wide awake and yet doesn't jar your nerves. With Tanya back on the scene, a steady job, the drunken talk about Russia, the walks home at night, and Paris in full summer, life seems to lift its head a little higher. That's why, perhaps, a letter such as Boris sent me seems absolutely cockeyed. Most every day I meet Tanya around 5 o'clock to have a porto with her, as she calls it. I let her take me to places I've never seen before. The swell bars around the Champs-Élysées, where the sound of jazz and baby voices crooning seems to soak right through the mahogany woodwork. Even when you go to the lavabo, these pulpy, sappy strains pursue you, come floating into the cabinet through the ventilators, and make life all soap and iridescent bubbles. And whether it's because Sylvester is away and she feels free now, or whatever it is, Tanya certainly tries to behave like an angel. "You treated me lousy just before I went away," she says to me one day. "Why did you want to act that way? I never did anything to hurt you, did I?" We were getting sentimental, what with the soft lights and that creamy mahogany music seeping through the place. It was getting near time to go to work, and we hadn't eaten yet. The stubs were lying there in front of us. 6 francs, 4.50, 7 francs, 2.50. I was counting them up mechanically and wondering, too, at the same time, if I would like it better being a bartender. Often like that when she was talking to me, gushing about Russia, the future, love, and all that crap, I'd get to thinking about the most irrelevant things, about shining shoes or being a lavatory attendant. Particularly, I suppose, because it was so cozy in these joints that she dragged me to, and it never occurred to me that I'd be stone sober and perhaps old and bent. No, I imagined always that the future, however modest, would be in just this sort of ambience, with the same tunes playing through my head and the glasses clinking, and behind every shapely ass, a trail of perfume a yard wide that would take the stink out of life, even downstairs in the lavabo. The strange thing is, it never spoiled me trotting around the swell bars with her like that. It was hard to leave her, certainly. I used to lead her around to the porch of a church near the office, and standing there in the dark, we'd take a last embrace, she whispering to me, "Jesus, what am I going to do now?" She wanted me to quit the job so I could make love night and day. She didn't even care about Russia anymore, just so long as we were together. But the moment I left her, my head cleared. It was another kind of music, not so croony, but good just the same, which greeted my ears when I pushed through the swinging door. And another kind of perfume, not just a yard wide, but omnipresent, a sort of sweat and patchouli that seemed to come from the machines. Coming in with a skinful, as I usually did, it was like dropping suddenly to a low altitude. Generally, I made a beeline for the toilet. That braced me up, rather. It was a little cooler there, or else the sound of water running made it seem so. It was always a cold douche, the toilet. It was real. Before you got inside, you had to pass a line of Frenchmen peeling off their clothes. Oh, but they stank, those devils. And they were well paid for it, too. But there they were. Stripped down, some in long underwear, some with beards, most of them pale, skinny rats with lead in their veins. Inside the toilet, you could take an inventory of their idle thoughts. The walls were crowded with sketches and epithets, all of them jocosely obscene, easy to understand, and on the whole rather jolly and sympathetic. It must have required a ladder to reach certain spots. But I suppose it was worthwhile doing it, even looking at it from just the psychological viewpoint. Sometimes, as I stood there taking a leak, I wondered what an impression it would make on those swell dames whom I observed passing in and out of the beautiful lavatories on the Champs-Élysées. I wondered if they would carry their tails so high, if they could see what was thought of an ass here. In their world, no doubt, everything was gauze and velvet. Or they made you think so with the fine scents they gave out, swishing past you. Some of them hadn't always been such fine ladies either. Some of them swished up and down like that just to advertise their trade. And maybe, when they were left alone with themselves, when they talked out loud in the privacy of their boudoirs, maybe some strange things fell out of their mouths, too. Because in that world, just as in every world, the greater part of what happens is just muck and filth, sordid as any garbage can. Only they are lucky enough to be able to put covers over the can. As I say, that afternoon life with Tanya never had any bad effect on me. Once in a while I'd get too much of a skinful, and I'd have to stick my finger down my throat, because it's hard to read proof when you're not all there. It requires more concentration to detect a missing comma than to epitomize Nietzsche's philosophy. You can be brilliant sometimes when you're drunk, but brilliance is out of place in the proofreading department. Dates, fractions, semicolons. These are the things that count. And these are the things that are most difficult to track down when your mind is all ablaze. Now and then I made some bad blunders, and if it weren't that I had learned how to kiss the boss's ass, I would have been fired, that's certain. I even got a letter one day from the big mogul upstairs, a guy I never even met, so high up he was. And between a few sarcastic phrases about my more-than-ordinary intelligence, he hinted pretty plainly that I'd better learn my place and toe the mark, or there'd be what's what to pay. Frankly, that scared the shit out of me. After that, I never used a polysyllabic word in conversation. In fact, I hardly ever opened my trap all night. I played the high-grade moron, which is what they wanted of us. Now and then, to sort of flatter the boss, I'd go up to him and ask politely what such and such a word might mean. He liked that. He was a sort of dictionary and timetable, that guy. No matter how much beer he guzzled during the break, and he made his own private breaks too, seeing as how he was running the show, you could never trip him up on a date or a definition. He was born to the job. My only regret was that I knew too much. It leaked out now and then, despite all the precautions I took. If I happened to come to work with a book under my arm, this boss of ours would notice it. And if it were a good book, it made him venomous. But I never did anything intentionally to displease him. I liked the job too well to put a noose around my neck. Just the same, it's hard to talk to a man when you have nothing in common with him. You betray yourself, even if you use only monosyllabic words. He knew goddamn well, the boss, that I didn't take the least bit of interest in his yarns. And yet, explain it how you will, it gave him pleasure to wean me away from my dreams and fill me full of dates and historical events. It was his way of taking revenge, I suppose. The result was that I developed a bit of a neurosis. As soon as I hit the air, I became extravagant. It wouldn't matter what the subject of conversation happened to be. As we started back to Montparnasse in the early morning, I'd soon turn the fire hose on it, squelch it, in order to trot out my perverted dreams. I liked best talking about those things which none of us knew anything about. I had cultivated a mild sort of insanity. Echolalia, I think it's called. All the tag ends of a night's proofing danced on the tip of my tongue. Dalmatia. I had held copy on an ad for that beautiful jewel resort. All right, Dalmatia. You take a train, and in the morning your pores are perspiring and the grapes are bursting their skins. I could reel it off about Dalmatia from the Grand Boulevard to Cardinal Mazarin's palace, further if I chose to. I don't even know where it is on the map, and I don't want to know ever. But at 3 in the morning, with all that lead in your veins, and your clothes saturated with sweat and patchouli, and the clink of bracelets passing through the ringer, and those beer yarns that I was braced for, little things like geography, costume, speech, architecture don't mean a goddamn thing. Dalmatia belongs to a certain hour of the night when those high gongs are snuffed out, and the court of the Louvre seems so wonderfully ridiculous that you feel like weeping for no reason at all, just because it's so beautifully silent, so empty, so totally unlike the front page, and the guys upstairs rolling the dice. With that little piece of Dalmatia resting on my throbbing nerves like a cold knife blade, I could experience the most wonderful sensations of voyage. And the funny thing is, again, that I could travel all around the globe, but America would never enter my mind. It was even further lost than a lost continent, because with the lost continents I felt some mysterious attachment, whereas with America I felt nothing at all. Now and then, it's true, I did think of Mona, not as of a person in a definite aura of time and space, but separately, detached, as though she had blown up into a great cloud-like form that blotted out the past. I couldn't allow myself to think about her very long. If I had, I would have jumped off the bridge. It's strange. I had become so reconciled to this life without her. And yet, if I thought about her only for a minute, it was enough to pierce the bone and marrow of my contentment and shove me back again into the agonizing gutter of my wretched past. For 7 years, I went about day and night with only one thing on my mind, her. Were there a Christian so faithful to his God as I was to her, we would all be Jesus Christ's today. Day and night I thought of her, even when I was deceiving her. And now, sometimes, in the very midst of things, sometimes when I feel that I am absolutely free of it all, suddenly, in rounding a corner perhaps, there will bob up a little square, a few trees and a bench, a deserted spot where we stood and had it out, where we drove each other crazy with bitter, jealous scenes. Always some deserted spot, like the Place de l'Estrapade, for example, or those dingy, mournful streets off the mosque, or along that open tomb of an Avenue de Breteuil, which at 10 o'clock in the evening is so silent, so dead, that it makes one think of murder or suicide, anything that might create a vestige of human drama. When I realize that she is gone, perhaps gone forever, a great void opens up. And I feel that I am falling, falling, falling into deep black space. And this is worse than tears, deeper than regret or pain or sorrow. It is the abyss into which Satan was plunged. There is no climbing back, no ray of light, no sound of human voice or human touch of hand. How many thousand times in walking through the streets at night have I wondered if the day would ever come again when she would be at my side? All those yearning looks I bestowed on the buildings and statues, I had looked at them so hungrily, so desperately, that by now my thoughts must have become a part of the very buildings and statues. They must be saturated with my anguish. I could not help but reflect also that when we had walked side by side through these mournful, dingy streets, now so saturated with my dream and longing, she had observed nothing, felt nothing. They were like any other streets to her, a little more sordid, perhaps, and that is all. She wouldn't remember that at a certain corner I had stopped to pick up her hairpin, or that when I bent down to tie her laces, I remarked the spot on which her foot had rested, and that it would remain there forever, even after the cathedrals had been demolished and the whole Latin civilization wiped out forever and ever. End of Side 9. Side 10. Walking down the Rue Lomond one night in a fit of unusual anguish and desolation, certain things were revealed to me with poignant clarity. Whether it was that I had so often walked this street in bitterness and despair, or whether it was the remembrance of a phrase which she had dropped one night as we stood at the Place Lucienaire, I do not know. "Why don't you show me that Paris," she said, "that you have written about?" One thing I know, that at the recollection of these words, I suddenly realized the impossibility of ever revealing to her that Paris which I had gotten to know, the Paris whose arrondissements are undefined, a Paris that has never existed except by virtue of my loneliness, my hunger for her. Such a huge Paris. It would take a lifetime to explore it again. This Paris, to which I alone had the key, hardly lends itself to a tour, even with the best of intentions. It is a Paris that has to be lived, that has to be experienced each day in a thousand different forms of torture. A Paris that grows inside you like a cancer, and grows and grows until you are eaten away by it. Stumbling down the Rue Mouffetard, with these reflections stirring in my brain, I recalled another strange item out of the past, out of that guidebook whose leaves she had asked me to turn, but which, because the covers were so heavy, I then found impossible to pry open. For no reason at all, because at the moment my thoughts were occupied with Salavin, in whose sacred precincts I was now meandering, for no reason at all, I say, there came to mind the recollection of a day when, inspired by the plaque which I passed day in and day out, I impulsively entered the Pension Orfila and asked to see the room Strindberg had occupied. Up to that time, nothing very terrible had befallen me, though I had already lost my worldly possessions and had known what it was to walk the streets in hunger and in fear of the police. Up to then, I had not found a single friend in Paris, a circumstance which was not so much depressing as bewildering, for wherever I have roamed in this world, the easiest thing for me to discover has been a friend. But in reality, nothing very terrible had happened to me yet. One can live without friends, as one can live without love, or even without money, that supposed sine qua non. One can live in Paris, I discovered that, on just grief and anguish, a bitter nourishment, perhaps the best there is for certain people. At any rate, I had not yet come to the end of my rope. I was only flirting with disaster. I had time and sentiment enough to spare to peep into other people's lives, to dally with the dead stuff of romance, which, however morbid it may be, when it is wrapped between the covers of a book, seems deliciously remote and anonymous. As I was leaving the place, I was conscious of an ironic smile hovering over my lips, as though I were saying to myself, "Not yet, the Pension Orfila." Since then, of course, I have learned what every madman in Paris discovers sooner or later, that there are no ready-made infernos for the tormented. It seems to me I understand a little better now why she took such huge delight in reading Strindberg. I can see her looking up from her book after reading a delicious passage, and with tears of laughter in her eyes saying to me, "You're just as mad as he was. You want to be punished." What a delight that must be to the sadist when she discovers her own proper masochist, when she bites herself, as it were, to test the sharpness of her teeth. In those days, when I first knew her, she was saturated with Strindberg. That wild carnival of maggots which he reveled in, that eternal duel of the sexes, that spiderish ferocity which had endeared him to the sodden oafs of the Northland, it was that which had brought us together. We came together in a dance of death, and so quickly was I sucked down into the vortex that when I came to the surface again, I could not recognize the world. When I found myself loose, the music had ceased, the carnival was over, and I had been picked clean. After leaving the Pension Orfila that afternoon, I went to the library, and there, after bathing in the Ganges and pondering over the signs of the zodiac, I began to reflect on the meaning of that inferno which Strindberg had so mercilessly depicted. And as I ruminated, it began to grow clear to me the mystery of his pilgrimage, the flight which the poet makes over the face of the earth. And then, as if he had been ordained to reenact a lost drama, the heroic descent to the very bowels of the earth, the dark and fearsome sojourn in the belly of the whale, the bloody struggle to liberate himself, to emerge clean of the past, a bright, gory sun god, cast up on an alien shore. It was no mystery to me any longer why he and the others, Dante, Rabelais, Van Gogh, etc., etc., had made their pilgrimage to Paris. I understood then why it is that Paris attracts the tortured, the hallucinated, the great maniacs of love. I understood why it is that here, at the very hub of the wheel, one can embrace the most fantastic, the most impossible theories, without finding them in the least strange. It is here that one reads again the books of his youth, and the enigmas take on new meanings, one for every white hair. One walks the streets knowing that he is mad, possessed, because it is only too obvious that these cold, indifferent faces are the visages of one's keepers. Here, all boundaries fade away, and the world reveals itself for the mad slaughterhouse that it is. The treadmill stretches away to infinitude. The hatches are closed down tight. Logic runs rampant with bloody cleaver flashing. The air is chill and stagnant. The language apocalyptic. Not an exit sign anywhere. No issue save death. A blind alley at the end of which is a scaffold. An eternal city, Paris. More eternal than Rome. More splendorous than Nineveh, the very navel of the world, to which, like a blind and faltering idiot, one crawls back on hands and knees. And like a cork that has drifted to the dead center of the ocean, one floats here in the scum and wrack of the seas, listless, hopeless, heedless even of a passing Columbus. The cradles of civilization are the putrid sinks of the world, the charnel house to which the stinking wombs confide their bloody packages of flesh and bone. The streets were my refuge, and no man can understand the glamour of the streets until he is obliged to take refuge in them, until he has become a straw that is tossed here and there by every zephyr that blows. One passes along a street on a wintry day, and, seeing a dog for sale, one is moved to tears, while across the way, cheerful as a cemetery, stands a miserable hut that calls itself Hôtel du Tombeau des Lapins. That makes one laugh fit to die, until one notices that there are hotels everywhere for rabbits, dogs, lice, emperors, cabinet ministers, pawnbrokers, horse knackers, and so on. And almost every other one is an Hôtel de l'Avenir, which makes one more hysterical still. So many hotels of the future. No hotels in the past participle. No subjunctive modes. No conjunctivitis. Everything is hoary, grisly, bristling with merriment, swollen with the future, like a gumboil. Drunk with this lecherous eczema of the future, I stagger over to the Place Violet. The colors all mauve and slate. The doorways, so low, that only dwarfs and goblins could hobble in. Over the dull cranium of Zola, the chimneys are belching pure coke, while the Madonna of sandwiches listens with cabbage ears to the bubbling of the gas tanks, those beautiful bloated toads which squat by the roadside. Why do I suddenly recollect the Passage des Thermopyles? Because that day, a woman addressed her puppy in the apocalyptic language of the slaughterhouse. And the little bitch, she understood what this greasy slut of a midwife was saying. How that depressed me. More even than the sight of those whimpering curs that were being sold on the Rue Brancion. Because it was not the dogs which filled me so with pity, but the huge iron railing, those rusty spikes which seemed to stand between me and my rightful life. In the pleasant little lane near the Abattoir de Vaugirard, Abattoir Hypophagique, which is called the Rue des Perrichots, I had noticed here and there signs of blood. Just as Strindberg in his madness had recognized omens and portents in the very flagging of the Pension Orfila, so as I wandered aimlessly through this muddy lane bestatted with blood, fragments of the past detached themselves and floated listlessly before my eyes, taunting me with the direst forebodings. I saw my own blood being spilled, the muddy road stained with it, as far back as I could remember. From the very beginning, doubtless. One is ejected into the world like a dirty little mummy. The roads are slippery with blood, and no one knows why it should be so. Each one is traveling his own way. And though the earth be rotting with good things, there is no time to pluck the fruits. The procession scrambles toward the exit sign, and such a panic is there, such a sweat to escape, that the weak and the helpless are trampled into the mud, and their cries are unheard. My world of human beings had perished. I was utterly alone in the world, and for friends I had the streets. And the streets spoke to me in that sad, bitter language compounded of human misery, yearning, regret, failure, wasted effort. Passing under the viaduct, along the Rue Broca, one night after I had been informed that Mona was ill and starving, I suddenly recalled that it was here in the squalor and gloom of this sunken street, terrorized perhaps by a premonition of the future, that Mona clung to me and with a quivering voice begged me to promise that I would never leave her, never, no matter what happened. And only a few days later, I stood on the platform of the Gare Saint-Lazare and watched the train pull out, the train that was bearing her away. And she was leaning out of the window, just as she had leaned out of the window when I left her in New York. And there was that same sad, inscrutable smile on her face, that last-minute look which is intended to convey so much, but which is only a mask that is twisted by a vacant smile. Only a few days before, she had clung to me desperately. And then something happened, something which is not even clear to me now. And of her own volition, she boarded the train, and she was looking at me again with that sad, enigmatic smile which baffles me, which is unjust, unnatural, which I distrust with all my soul. And now it is I, standing in the shadow of the viaduct, who reach out for her, who cling to her desperately. And there is that same inexplicable smile on my lips, the mask that I have clamped down over my grief. I can stand here and smile vacantly, and no matter how fervid my prayers, no matter how desperate my longing, there is an ocean between us. There she will stay and starve, and here I shall walk from one street to the next, the hot tears scalding my face. It is that sort of cruelty which is embedded in the streets. It is that which stares out from the walls and terrifies us when suddenly we respond to a nameless fear, when suddenly our souls are invaded by a sickening panic. It is that which gives the lampposts their ghoulish twists, which makes them beckon to us and lure us to their strangling grip. It is that which makes certain houses appear like guardians of secret crimes, and their blind windows like the empty sockets of eyes that have seen too much. It is that sort of thing written into the human physiognomy of the streets, which makes me flee when overhead I suddenly see inscribed, "Impasse Satan." That which makes me shudder when at the very entrance to the mosque I observe that it is written, "Mondays and Thursdays, tuberculosis. Wednesdays and Fridays, syphilis." In every metro station there are grinning skulls that greet you with, "Défendez-vous contre la syphilis." Wherever there are walls, there are posters with bright venomous crabs heralding the approach of cancer. No matter where you go, no matter what you touch, there is cancer and syphilis. It is written in the sky. It flames and dances like an evil portent. It has eaten into our souls, and we are nothing but a dead thing, like the moon. I think it was the 4th of July when they took the chair from under my ass again. Not a word of warning. One of the big muckamucks from the other side of the water had decided to make economies, cutting down on proofreaders and helpless little dactylo enabled him to pay the expenses of his trips back and forth, and the palatial quarters he occupied at the Ritz. After paying what little debts I had accumulated among the linotype operators, and a goodwill token at the bistro across the way, in order to preserve my credit, there was scarcely anything left out of my final pay. I had to notify the patron of the hotel that I would be leaving. I didn't tell him why, because he'd have worried about his measly 200 francs. "What'll you do if you lose your job?" That was the phrase that rang in my ears continually. "Ça y est maintenant, ausgespielt." Nothing to do but get down into the street again, walk, hang around, sit on benches, kill time. By now, of course, my face was familiar in Montparnasse. For a while, I could pretend that I was still working on the paper. That would make it a little easier to bum a breakfast or a dinner. It was summertime, and the tourists were pouring in. I had schemes up my sleeve for mulcting them. "What'll you do?" Well, I wouldn't starve, that's one thing. If I should do nothing else but concentrate on food, that would prevent me from falling to pieces. For a week or two, I could still go to Monsieur Paul's and have a square meal.